Baruchim Abayim, ladies. Today we are studying the lesson, the Fuash Lemachana Hayabat Mazal, that in the zchut of our studying and our sacrifice today, God should give her a Fuash Lemah B'toch Sh'ar Chodei Amo Yisrael. Amen. We are studying Parashat Kinehas. Parashat Pinehas is actually the sequel to last week's Parashah. Let's just review what happened quickly so we understand the context of the story. Last week we read about Bil'am, the great anti-Semite that tried to verbally terrorize the Jewish people. He was planning on cursing the Jewish nation at a specific moment, and his intent was to cause great destruction, actually to annihilate our people, God forbid. He was unsuccessful. As a matter of fact, as we learned, it backfired in his face. Instead of cursing, he actually blessed. And we said some of those blessings are still used today at some of our most momentous occasions. For example, at our weddings, some of the communities have a custom, ours does, that we say some of the poems about the beauty of marriage from words that Bil'am himself authored. So it was he thought he's going to curse. He didn't realize that we're going to use his songs at our weddings. So it couldn't be a bigger failure on Bil'am's part. So then he went for plan number two, an alternate plan, where unfortunately he was somewhat successful. He told Balak. Balak was the one that hired him. He said, listen, the God of the Jews hates promiscuity. He knew that. A lot of Jews don't know that. But Bil'am knows exactly how much God hates promiscuity. The way they say it in Hebrew is Eloheim shel elu sone zima. Zima means illicit behavior, immodest behavior. So he said, if we can get them to sin with their lust, their passion, and do something that's immoral, then God automatically will turn on them. There's no way it can backfire. Balak says, I'm in. What's the plan? So Bil'am created a whole ruse, a scheme. He enticed the Jewish people with the woman of Midian. Amazing how it turned out, but a lot of the Jews succumbed to their base desires and they committed the sin with the daughters of Midian, and 24,000 Jews died. So this was a big triumph for Bil'am, and Bil'am was saying, oh, look at that, I was able to get at least a part of them. And the truth is, it would have been more were it not for the hero of this week's Parashah, a man by the name of Phinehas. Phinehas single-handedly stopped the plague. What did he do? He took out his sword, his romach, his spear, and he saw one of the perpetrators of the sin was a tribal leader. His name was Zimri. Of course, Jewish man, but wasn't only Jewish man. He was a tribal leader. He was supposed to be an important guy. And he took a Moavi or Midiani woman, and he committed the sin. And when Pinchas saw this, he said, it even got to the tribal leader that he's also committing the sin. This is disastrous. So on his own, he took the spear and he went and he daggered both of them simultaneously. It's a little gory. But after he did it and he killed them, it says the plague stopped. And the Torah goes to great lengths to say, Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the grandson of Aharon, he is the one that avenged the anger of God, and he caused the plague to stop. And because of him, God says, I did not consume my people. So he really saved the day. But the Hachamim tell us that although we give great credit to Phinehas for what he did, it was a courageous act, and he really saved millions of Jews from their death. The Jews in his time did not appreciate what he did as much as we do. The Jews started to criticize Pinchas. Who is he? Who is he to go and start killing a tribal leader? But he's the one that's going to go starting to do it. He had personal interests. He had bad motivation. He was doing it for ulterior motives. And they started to criticize what Pinchas did. And our rabbis learned from over here a great truth about the nature of the Jewish people. The man just saved your life. The man just stopped the plague. You should take this man and make a ticker tape parade for him. You should give him a bonus. You should give him medallions. You should put his name in every newspaper and say, Pinchas is the most important person of the generation. Instead, what the Jews do, they criticize. They knock a guy. Yeah, but he wasn't the guy who should have done it. Who does he think he is? Unfortunately, ladies, this attitude today still prevails. Our leaders, namely our rabbis, their job is a very uncomfortable job. Trust me, I'm a rabbi. I know the job. It's uncomfortable for a rabbi to have to get up and say things that are unpopular, to say things that are maybe will ruffle some people, or to say a rebuke, or to chastise. I think about myself, it would be much easier just to get up all the time and say everything's good, everything is peaceful, the community is wonderful, our people are great, there are no problems, the weather is nice, the homes are beautiful, the summer is great. And everybody would sit in the crowd and say, oh, what a positive speech, what a nice thing, the rabbi's so upbeat, everything's good and all that. But a rabbi has a very difficult job. It's his responsibility to point out from time to time the faults of the people. It's his job to point out what's going wrong. Not in order to be a party pooper, but in order to remind the people what the purpose of life is, what we're here for, to remind them of their priorities, to put life back into focus, to give a perspective. But unfortunately, what happens today has happened then. It doesn't change. The leaders try and do their job and give the proper diagnosis to the patient. And of course, you hear people, who is the rabbi to tell us this? Who does he think he is? Why does he have to point out the bad? Why does he have to talk about this? Can he talk about something that's pov? Can he talk about something that's less offensive? I agree. It's not the job of a rabbi to get up every single speech and rebuke and chastise. This is uncalled for. However, from time to time, like Pinchas, I agree, it's not the norm for a leader to go out, take his sword, and every time he sees a sinner and go start, you know, shish kebabbing them and killing them. That's clear. But from time to time, a leader must make a stand, he must give an opinion, and it's because of those opinions that we still have a community today. It's almost like going to a doctor. We probably mentioned it last week, and I'll say it 1,000 more times. And when our doctors tell us, you know, you have this and this, no, I don't want to hear bad news. It's not up to me to tell you bad news or good news. I'm giving you a prognosis. That's the job of the hachamim. And therefore, whether we're ready to hear it or not, at least we cannot be critical when leadership is doing their job. They'd rather not do it. It's easier for them just to say, close our eyes, and not say anything. That's the lesson of the beginning of the parasha. Pinchas, as a result of what he did, he was rewarded with a peace covenant with God. It says he was rewarded what's called Biriti Shalom. I never understood what that means. What does it mean he got a peace covenant from God? But does that mean he got a paper, a document, a trophy? What does it mean he got a Birit Shalom? I saw from one of the rabbis called the Netziv, he explained it. The Goyim say you are what you eat. There's some truth to that. In Judaism we preach something a little different. You are what you do. Which means, based on the actions that you do, that'll affect your character. Our personality is molded by our actions. If a person does favors and kindness and goodness, that'll change his character into being more soft, more compassionate. The more good deeds you do, the more it'll affect your nature. Maimonides writes, what's better, to give $100 to charity or to give 100 poor people $1 each? So he says, in truth, giving $100 is more beneficial because the person could do something with a substantial donation. What are you going to do with a dollar? But for the person that's giving, at least in the beginning of his giving, in the beginning of his charitable career, it's better to give 100 times. Why? Because it'll train his hand to put his hand in his pocket and give. The more you give, it's contagious. So therefore, in the beginning, when we want to get you to break that stinginess, yeah, take $100 bills and just keep on going like this. We want you to get into the habit of going, giving money and passing money, and eventually your nature will change. So deeds change a person. The opposite is also true. Bad deeds affect the person's character. Pinchas over here, he just murdered somebody. It was a mitzvah, it was legal, it brought great benefit, but bottom line, there was a chance that that murder could leave a negative trace on Pinchas, which means it could make him more cruel now. Even if he's killing with a license to kill, but still there's a chance that it could cause his nature to become more cold or more brutal. Listen, killing doesn't make you more compassionate. It doesn't make you kinder. So that wouldn't be fair. Azit Pinchas is trying to do a good thing, and as a result of doing the mitzvah, why now? So his nature should now be a little affected negatively? So what does God tell him? I am going to give you a peace covenant, which means I'm going to neutralize all the negative that came out of this act. Your personality will not be affected. Which means God said, I'm going to offset it. Since you were doing something that was right and was legal and was justified, it wouldn't be fair to you now to suffer a personality change because of it. It wouldn't be fair now that you should become more callous to human life because you had to murder when it was legal. And therefore the peace covenant that God's giving Pinchas is a way of saying the mitzvah will not taint you. The mitzvah will not have any after effects that are negative. There'll be no bad fallout on it. The Berit Shalom neutralizes any bad that comes out. From here, Hakamim learn a great lesson that no bad can come from good. When one is involved in a mitzvah, Borei Olam will protect him and see to it that his nature will not change for the bad. For example, sometimes in doing chesed, part of chesed is not to do chesed. Now this you have to learn also. Sometimes, in English today, the psychologists might call it tough love. But certain times, doing chesed is not called for. Sometimes you have to be a little strict. So the person will say, yeah, but I'm going to become hardened because of this now. I don't want to become bad because of it. The Torah is telling you, if you're doing it for the sake of God, in order to help somebody by being a little strict and being a little stern with them, there'll be no effect on your nature. Since you were doing it for the right intention, you can't go wrong from sin, from mitzvah. Mitzvah does not bring a loss on all accounts. Not to the person you're helping, not to your own personality. It's a win-win. You don't think, oh, well, if I do this mitzvah, but I might have to lose it. Even in life, you say, you talk to a businessman that might have to interrupt his day to pray. You know, the hardest prayer of the day is not the morning prayer, shacharit, nor the evening prayer, arbit. Because shacharit, they can always get up early and pray. No matter what time you have to get to work, you can always get up a half hour early and pray. Arbit, you can always pray before you go to bed. So it really doesn't interrupt anything. But mincha is smack in the middle of the afternoon. Especially in the winter, you know. So tell a guy at 3 o'clock you have to stop for 15 minutes and pray. What are you talking about? I have customers, I have appointments, I'm talking, I'm going, I'm buying, I'm selling. So that's the biggest sacrifice. So a person says, well, if I'm going to pray mincha, I'm going to lose. You won't lose. You can't lose. A mitzvah does not have in it a loss. God's not going to punish you and hold you accountable. Oh, you prayed mincha? Now you're not going to get the order. Does that make sense? On the contrary, it makes sense the other way. Oh, you didn't give 15 minutes of your day for me, now you want to make all that money? So I have to learn that in life. Many of us have things to do. We sacrifice our time to come to the class. So, oh, I lost out now because I came to the class, I wasn't able to. It doesn't work that way. In mitzvot, it's never you lost out. It's never because I learned, because I came to study, I wasn't able to. When you weren't able to. It'll happen, it'll work out, it's good. I know myself, when I was young in the yeshiva, any time that I tried to take away from my learning time, which was a set learning time, to go do my personal benefits or pleasures or to, you know, go out with the boys to do something, and I stole an hour of my learning, somehow it always got messed up. I thought I'm going to save an extra hour by leaving the shiur early, and we got delayed and it didn't work out, and I could have went an hour late, I would have been on time anyway. And then you think to yourself, look what it is, I thought I was going to gain by not doing the mitzvah, and I didn't gain anything, and then I lost. I didn't get there, I didn't do what I wanted, and I ended up not getting the mitzvah as well. It's a good attitude to always remember. You never lose from doing a mitzvah. There's another point that should be mentioned. Hakamim tell us that right after this episode, Borei Olam counts the people. There's a census held. You know, the book of Bamidbar, ladies, in English we call the book of Bamidbar the book of numbers, even though Bamidbar really means a desert. But they don't call it the book of desert. This is called the book of numbers, because God counts the people twice in this book. In the beginning of the book, and once again in this parasha, which is the end of the book. He counts every single tribe, how many children, how many grandchildren. Why does he do that? So that Chachamim tells us it's like a shepherd that has sheep. And the wolves came in and they started to attack the sheep. After the attack is over, the shepherd wants to know inventory. How many sheep does he have left? So he has to start counting them again. Here we just had a plague. We lost 24,000 Jews. So God comes along and starts, you know, to recount us to see who's left. He doesn't have to count for his sake. He knows how much was left. But he does it to show how much he loves us. He's trying to show us, look how much I love you. You're like sheep to a shepherd. You're dear to me. And therefore I want to make sure who's left. But the Hafetz Chaim points out a fantastic chiddush in the census numbers. There are two tribes here that are counted out of the 12. Well, I was going to say, let me give you a chart to make it easier for us. The tribe of Binyamin, their total population at this point in history was 45,600. You don't have to remember the numbers. The tribe of Dan, their total numbers were 64,400. Okay, it doesn't bother anybody. Nobody's going to, you know, get excited over those two figures. But you will in a second. Basically, Dan had 20,000 more people than Binyamin. A big deal. Says the Hafetz Chaim, it's a big deal. Because if you know anything about Binyamin and Dan, Binyamin was one of the 12 tribes. How many children did Binyamin have? 10. He had 10 sons. Dan, who was another one of the 12 tribes, he only had one son. Now you would think, if you're a statistician, if you're an actuary, you'd say, hold it. 10 sons are bound to produce more descendants than one son. So if you're taking a bet, you'd say, there's no question, hands down, Binyamin should be at least 10 times greater than the tribe of Dan. But let's add something else to this equation. Dan's one son was a special child. He was deaf, God forbid. He was handicapped. So just imagine when Dan and Binyamin go with their families to visit Yaakov Abinu. Just picture the Shabbat table. And Binyamin walks in with his 10 children, each guy's big guy, they're all sitting down. And then Dan walks in with this handicapped one child. He has to think to himself, well, what's going to be with me? You know, look at my brother over here, Dan. Binyamin's got all these kids. Look what's the future of what this family is going to produce. What do I got? I got one kid. He can't even hear. Mesquine. So, what could happen? What could be the consequence of this? That's if you're thinking according to human logic. But in God's world, there's no such thing as statistics. There's no such thing as odds. There's no such thing as numbers. From that one handicapped child, produce 64,000 descendants. 20,000 more than Binyamin, who had 10 children. Defies all odds. And the Torah is going out of its way to show us a few messages here. Number one, God's in control. And therefore nothing's beyond God's capability. Now, how many times do we try to play God and we think to ourselves, how is our children going to make a living? It's impossible. How are they going to make the living? They can't. They do. And the truth is, if you put it on paper and you figure it out, there's no way they should be making a living. And it doesn't make sense. There's no way they should be making enough money to live. But at the end of the day, Borei Olam says, handle it. Don't worry about it. You don't go according to your understanding. We say, a person might think to himself, I'm never going to get married. I'm not going to get married. I have this problem and that hang up and this issue and that thing. You're right. According to the normal way of thinking, there's no way the guy should really get married or a girl should ever get married. But we're not working with normal situation. We're working with God. It's the same God that when the Hashmonaim had their small army of a few men, they were able to topple the Greek Empire. Is that normal? A band of 25 rabbis are able to bring down the Greek Empire? The history never says it'll never happen again. It's impossible, but it happened. In God, there's no such thing as numbers. You can't anticipate the conclusion. There's no way to figure out what's going to happen when it comes to God. And if we have that faith, there's no situation that's so bad, and there's no situation that's so dire that cannot turn around in a second. Dan over here, at the end of this, look at this, 64,000 from a handicapped child. But it's also a great lesson, not only of faith in God and belief in God, that anything could turn around at any moment. I like to say that, it makes me feel good to know that. Anything could change around in a second. It's a good idea to keep in your mind. No matter how bad a situation or how seemingly difficult the situation looks, for God it's easy. You can just, it's one nothing. And it's good. It's great. But there's another lesson over here. Look how important every Jewish child is. Unfortunately, or fortunately, is probably the better way to say it, if you're looking at it the right perspective, there are many parents that have this challenge in dealing with special children. Special children not only mean handicapped, like deafness of the son of Dan, but God forbid, different type of handicaps, different type of sicknesses, different type of infirmities. God should save us and protect our people. Amen. But at the same time, over there, parent has to know, and it's a great challenge, and it's very difficult. It's not easy to raise these children, but you have to understand that there's a value to these children. Look at this: from one handicapped child, look what it did to the world. It brought 64,000 descendants, and therefore, you can never discount a Jew. Every single Jew is important. Every single Jew has a value. Every single Jew has a worth. And therefore, if God entrusted a person with a special child, what's going to come out of this? You don't know what's going to come out of it. You have 64,000 Sadiqim come out of one handicapped deaf child. So who knows how the world will be affected. But it's a comforting thought to parents to know that even some of the greatest men in our religion, the tribes themselves, had to grapple with modern day problems that we have today, dealing with children that have special needs. Imagine that. Yaakov had grandchildren that had special needs. You had to talk to them in sign language. But at the end, look what they produce. So there's something good that does come out. I want to remind you, Hazon Ish used to stand up in front of mentally disabled children. It means when a mentally disabled child, God forbid, would walk in the room, he would stand up like he's standing in front of a great rabbi. So they asked Hazon Ish, they said, he's standing up in front of him, he doesn't have even an IQ. He said, you should know that these children are pure, and God gives them holy souls of great Sadiqim that needed to come back into this world just to fix minor adjustments, and therefore there's no purpose for them to have ability to think or talk because they're perfect already. They just need to adjust one small detail. Therefore they're holy people, they're pure and have no sin. And therefore we stand up from them like they're the greatest hakamim. So that's also comforting to a parent to know that there is a mission that they have, there is a purpose, and they're going to be rewarded that much greater for doing that job. But that continues. But that then tells us about some ladies that came to Moshe Rabbeinu. These were the daughters of a man called Selofhad. Let's review this story so you understand what's happening. There was a man called Selofhad. He lived in the desert with the Jewish people. He was Mehalel Shabbat. He did something on Shabbat he wasn't allowed to do, and the punishment was they stoned him. The problem with Selofhad was he had no boys. He only had girls. Now in Judaism, as you know, ladies, the inheritance rules favor the boys. Ladies married usually, and she has money from her husband, but the boys usually get inheritance. Now the daughters of Selofhad, they got nervous. They said, "Hold it, our father's dead. We're going into Israel now. It means we're not going to get a piece of the land of Israel. They're splitting up the land of Israel. All the boys are getting a piece of the land. Well, so our family now should get denied any land in Israel because there's no boys in the family. That's it. We're out. Our portion is going to be given to somebody else, and we're left landless." So they came to Moshe Rabbeinu with a claim. It's not fair. Our father died. Okay, so they killed him. Listen, he wasn't part of Korach's rebellion. His own sin that he did. And now we're going into Israel soon. It's not right. We deserve a piece of the land. Moshe Rabbeinu says, the truth is, it's a good question. Let me ask God. Ask God. I want to just say something in parentheses at this point. Look at the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu. You know, I'll get back to you. So let me get God on the line over here. Amazing, amazing man over here. Go. As if he had instant access to ask God. He's talking to his friend. You know, let me talk to God. Who says God's going to talk to you, Moshe? He was so certain. He knew his level that he was a great prophet. And he knew that God loved him. And that's the relationship that Moshe Rabbeinu had with Borei Olam. It's mind-blowing that a human being could reach such levels. So he picks up the red phone, whatever it is, he asks God. God tells him, they're right. It's a good claim. Why should they get denied the land? Tell them, they'll get a piece of the land in Israel. Don't worry about it. Comes back to them, you're going to get land. Oh, thank you very much. Comes the Midrash on this episode and says the following. The Midrash says, there were a few people in history that based on their good deeds and their behavior, not only did they receive reward for what they did, but they get reward for all the Jewish nation. They get reward as if they get everybody else's zechut goes to their account. One example the Midrash says was Noah. Noah, God told him, build a teba. 120 years he built the Teba, he lived on the Teba for a year. Not only does he get credit, the Midrash says, for what he did, but he gets credit for his entire generation. Which means everybody else who didn't listen to God, Noah gets their zechuyot. So it's like a wholesale situation. He doesn't only get one mitzvah, but he ends up with millions of mitzvot. He takes everybody else's mitzvot. Abraham is another example, they say. Abraham was one man against the whole world. He was preaching monotheism. He was saying there's one God. The rest of the world was saying, no, paganism. There's many gods. The Midrash says, Abraham doesn't only get credit for what he did, but he gets credit for everybody else. All their mitzvot go to him. The Midrash gives another example of Lot. Lot went to Sodom. Lot was a good guy in Sodom. They were bad. So he gets his zechut and everybody else's credit also. I want you to understand what I'm saying, ladies. It doesn't mean that he gets their mitzvot, their good deeds that they did. Their good deeds remain by them. Which means since they didn't do the right thing, he gets credit as if he did the right things times a million. Times all those people that didn't. He's not taking anything from them that belongs to them. The Midrash's last example is the most fascinating. It's this case. The daughters of Selofhad, they came to Moshe Rabbeinu and they said, "Oh, we want a piece of the action. We want a piece of Israel." God says, they're going to get reward, and they're going to get everybody else's reward with it. Comes the rabbis and stop and say, "What are you talking about? What was this good deed that they did over here? I understand Noah did a good deed. He fought the entire world. They were throwing stones at him when he was building the Tevah. Don't do it. What are you listening to God for? There's not going to be a flood. So he had to fight the entire world. So I understand why you're magnifying his credit. You're giving him more credit because he did it under difficult circumstance. Even Avraham Avinu, I understand. I mean, listen, he was thrown into a fiery furnace. They tried to kill Avraham Avinu. So I understand why you want to magnify Avraham's credit, because he fought the entire establishment. Even Lot had to fight all the decadence of Sodom. What are you talking about? The daughters of Selofhad? They came to court, the probate court. They said, "Listen, we want real estate." That's not a mitzvah. On the contrary, they were trying to negotiate. You want to say that they were shrewd businesswomen? You want to say that they had, you know, good acumen? But it doesn't sound like they were doing a mitzvah over here. They were coming and trying to stand up for their rights. "Hey, listen, it's not right. We don't have any brothers. Why should we be denied? What shechut is this over here?" So listen to what the rabbis answer. Very applicable lesson. The rabbis answer, it wasn't what they did and wasn't what they said, but it's when they said it. This story, you know when it took place? Right after the Jewish people started to complain to Moshe and tell Moshe, "We want to go back to Egypt. We don't want to go to Israel. Take us back to the old country. We'll be happier. You're taking us to kill us. Israel's no good." You know, the Jews many times during their sojourn in the desert always complained that they wanted to go back to Egypt. This story happened at one of those events where the momentum of the Jewish nation was they want to go back. And all of a sudden these girls come along and say, "Not only do we want to go to Israel, but it's not fair. We want a piece of the land." And Moshe Rabbeinu says, "What? Ladies, do you hear what's going on? Do you hear the sentiment is against what you're saying? They're all saying they want to go back to Israel, to Egypt. And at that moment you're coming along and saying, no, you want to go, you want to have a land." That's why their credit is magnified. If they would have came at a regular time in history and just said, "You know, we have rights, we want our rights, okay, we'll give you, here's a piece of land." But the fact that you came at a time where living in Israel was unpopular, where everybody else, all their friends were saying, "What do we got to go to Israel for? Let's stay back in Egypt. What do we need it for?" At that moment where the pressure against going to Israel was mounting and was so strong, at that moment to go to Moshe Rabbeinu and demand a piece of Israel, that's a great zechut. Ladies, you learn a great lesson from this. From here you learn that God rewards us not only for the deeds that we do, but He rewards us when we do them. They once asked the great Kabbalist, "How could Mashiach come in our time? We're not greater than the rabbis of yesteryear or the Gemara. We're not greater than the generation of the Talmud. If he didn't come in that generation when they were all righteous, we expect him to come in our society, in our culture. We don't stand a shot for Mashiach coming." It's a good question. Know what he answered? I'll give you an example of basically what he answered. Who's greater? They have a fellow that lives in Maasharim, one of the most religious neighbors in the world. His wife's dressed modestly with wigs and hats on wigs and wigs on hats. And the husband, of course, is dedicated to the synagogue and he goes to shul and he learns and all that. Of course, that couple is going to receive reward for the learning, for the modesty, for the Jewish lifestyle. No question. God pays people for their obedience. Now take another person that lives in Diyu, who does the same thing. It can't be the same reward. Because in Me'at Shearim, everybody's doing it. So therefore, I'm not saying it's easy, but it's definitely easier. But there's a positive peer pressure where if you don't learn, you're a fool. And if you don't dress modest, you're an outcast. So therefore, you're almost forced to do it. But God rewards you for that. But do the same things, same act, pound for pound. Do it in a society where it's not accepted, or where it's more difficult for a man to get up early in the morning. He might receive flack from his friends. What are you doing? What are you getting up early? What are you killing yourself for? To go study for? What are you? We're going out tonight. What are you going to the class for? Modesty for sure became an endangered species in our society, where it's almost unfound. And for a lady to be modest in our time today, it's much more credit than the rabbis of the Tanaim. When their wives were modest, it was the norm. It was fashionable to be modest. So don't get reward limited. But in our time, since it's so against society, everything we're doing, society's telling us, you're crazy. Not only society. Jews are telling us we're crazy. How many Orthodox Jews do we have? And how many observant Orthodox Jews? And how many Torah observant? We're a fraction of a fraction of a fraction. And the rest of the world is saying they're crazy. It's like a tribe of fanatics. And therefore, every time we do a mitzvah, we're up against the entire world. Every time we want to be modest, we're up against the entire world. Every time we want to do something good, pressure. Family members, community members, all becomes... But you have to know, it's very important to know, that because of the time that we're doing this mitzvah, the reward is that much greater. When ladies come out to study on a Friday afternoon in Deal, New Jersey, it's not, you're not getting an hour today. You don't get an hour of learning. You get 1,000 hours. Because look what you're up against. Look how many other things. Look at the competition that's out there. Look at the other things that are possible and the other things that can lure us away from studying. And that's what we learn from the daughters of Selofhad. If they would have came in a different generation to Moshe Rabbeinu and said, you know what, we want a piece of the land of Israel. Okay, let me ask God, yeah, no. But they came at a time when everybody was saying, who wants Israel? And they said, no, you're wrong. Israel's good. Oh, you get not only your credit, but you get credit for the whole generation. I always tell the boys in class, boys, never count how many people came to class. What you should count is how many people didn't come to class. Because all those people that didn't come to class, we wish they will come visit the Shem. But in the meantime, you get all their credit. All those thousands of people, your zechut, they didn't cash in their learning hours, you get their learning hours. All goes to your account. They have 100 ladies sitting in the room, God bless you all. But there's thousands that are not here. They didn't hear about it. I give them the benefit of the doubt. They'll be here next week. I'm not saying they won't be here. But the point is, those that are not interested, you know, those that don't bother me with learning, don't bother me with a class. You know, I don't want to get brainwashed by that stuff. Leave me alone with that. You know, the zombies. I don't want to get involved with that. Thank you. You just took it. You took the hour. You're not interested in redeeming your hour of learning? I'll take that hour. Thank you very much. So you're walking out now with thousands of hours to your credit. And that's why Mashiach can come in our generation. Because for us to be religious, it's much more difficult. For us to be observant, it's much more harder for us to do the right thing in the year 2004 than it was in the year 130 B.C., I'm sure they had their challenges then and their tests, but it's incomparable to the level of Yetzer Hara that we have in our generation. We're being bombarded from all fronts. There was a great rabbi called the Me'idi. The Me'idi once said, the truth is very heavy. Therefore, very few people are able to carry it. Very important thing he said. That you should never be deterred and say, you know, look at me, maybe I'm the crazy one. You know, maybe everybody else. The Torah says you got to follow the majority. Maybe they know. You know, maybe that free lifestyle and carefree way, maybe they know. And you always have to keep that in mind. The truth is very heavy. Very few people can carry the truth. I once asked this question to Rabbi Miller, alav shalom, when I came back from Israel. Of course, we studied in Israel for a few years, and the Torah has a way to open a person's eyes, to make him see things in a little more clearer light. So at that point, I accepted upon myself certain changes in life, which we all do from time to time. Having a lot of friends, it wasn't so easy for them to accept my adjustments. To me, it was easy. I was focused. I had clarity. So it was obvious. But for them, they had a hard time accepting it. So I went to Rabbi Miller. I'll never forget. May God bless his memory. And I asked him this question, what do I do? So he said, young man, I'm going to give you an example. There was 100 men that set up to climb Mount Everest. It's a great achievement if they could pull it off. At the bottom of the mountain, all 100 are there, and they're excited, and they're gung-ho, and they start to climb the mountain. As they get 1,000 feet up the mountain, 10 people back out. It's too hard, you can't do it. Another 1,000 feet, they lose another 10 people. And as they ascend the mountain, more and more people start to fall out. At the end of the day, when they're getting towards the peak, maybe there's 3 or 4 left. And then to finally get to the top of the mountain, maybe you have 2 people that are able to make it. He said, young man, religion is the same thing. At the bottom of the mountain of religion, everybody's there. But as you start to ascend and get clarity and start seeing things in their true perspective, you're going to lose some people. Either because they're not ready, it's too difficult, they don't want to sacrifice, whatever it is. But is that guy that's on the close to the peak of Everest going to say, hey, where's everybody? You know what? Let me go down and get them. What are you talking about? You're the hero. It's obvious that not everybody is going to be able to make such strides. When he told me that, it gave me a lot of confidence. Meaning, I always thought of that. Even till today, I think of that. Which means you're right. So they don't understand. They're still on the lower part of them. And they'll get there one day. So in the meantime, what should I do? I should stop ascending the mountain? I'll be a hero one day when I reach the top of the mountain. Then they'll say, oh, look at that. And it's truth. The rabbi was so right. After that, so many of my friends that I went to school with, not that I accomplished anything, but just with the little things that we're doing, they came to me and they said, oh, why didn't you take us with you? Where were you? You left us. The same people that were trying to hold us back, when they woke up, they said, wow, look where you are. How come you didn't tell us? We were trying to tell you, but you were telling us the opposite at the time. No, I wasn't. It's hard to relive the history exactly. But the point is, the daughters of Sulukha teach us a fantastic lesson that you have to know. Living in our generation is a great, great challenge for us. But every mitzvah you do, you're on bonus points. It's not anymore one for one. Every good deed you do in this generation, it's 100, 1,000 to 1. Not because that the deed got better. The deed's the same deed. But the context that the deed is being done in changed. And since the context of the deed changed, that makes the world a difference. So I have good news. Mashiach will come in our generation. Because there hasn't been a worse generation than ours. Our generation has even surpassed the expectation of the Yetzer Hara himself. I don't think the Yetzer Hara imagined that he'd be able to bring us to such levels. But because of that, new righteous ladies, you're going to bring the Mashiach through your good deeds. May he be blessed. May continued Continue the good work. Continue climbing the mountain. All the rabbis and all your teachers are proud of you for what you're doing. And Am Yisrael is going to be eternally indebted to you for your good work and for your accomplishments in bringing the Mashiach that much closer. Ladies, they asked me to collect some tzedakah for some people. If you want to put it on the teba, we'll have class next week at 11:30 as planned.